And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Michelle Kuo to the program today. Michelle graduated from Harvard Law and teaches in the History, Law, and Society program at the American University of Paris on issues related to race, punishment, immigration, and the law. Today we'll be talking about her debut book, a memoir, Reading with Patrick, a Teacher, a Student, and a Life-Changing Friendship, and it's published by Random House. So, Michelle, how did a native Michigander end up in the Arkansas Delta?
Oh, gosh. Yes, it is true. I am from Michigan.
Which part of the mitten?
Oh, you know about the mitten. That's great. He's showing up his hand, which is the nerdy, cool thing that we Michiganders do. I'm on the west part of the hand, and it's from a town called Kalamazoo.
Which is one of the best town names in America,
I think. It is, definitely. I definitely had a shirt that I wore all the time that said, yes, there really is a Kalamazoo. I was very proud of that shirt. So I ended up in Arkansas through Teach for America, this program that sends people all over the country to rural areas that need teachers. And the region that I was my top choice was called Mississippi Delta, which includes Arkansas, Mississippi. And they sent me to Helena, Arkansas, which is in Phillips County, one of the poorest counties in America. And I had no idea what to expect.
Now, I've had some experience. I've been over to the King Biscuit Festival.
Oh, you have? Yes. I love the Blues Festival. It's the happiest time of the year in Helena.
But it must have been a culture shock for you to go down there.
It was, although I don't even think I understood what a shock it was until I was preparing to leave 2 years later when I realized what I had become attached to and what I also was fleeing. The thing that startled me the most was just how many boarded up stores and houses there were. The thing that startled me next was that I taught at an alternative school, which was basically like a school for the quote-unquote bad kids. And they had a lot of issues. Some of them had been expelled. Some of them were too old. And I didn't know how to connect with them. And that was a shock to me because I thought, hey, I get along with lots of people. How can I not connect with these students?
And it must have been very much different seeing rural poverty as opposed to city poverty, urban poverty.
Yeah, I had worked at a homeless shelter in Boston, so I thought I knew what poverty looked like. I had seen people begging for beds on the coldest, snowiest nights of the year. But rural poverty is really different than urban poverty, and it's a story that doesn't get told in America. It's not in the coastal newspapers.
And I was just looking at statistics for Phillips County, and just over the past few years, it's lost 5,000 people, and it doesn't really have 5,000 people to lose.
That's absolutely the biggest difference between rural and urban poverty is I think it's hard for people from the city to imagine what it's like to be a depopulated town, to always be losing your best and brightest, for high school graduation to mean we might never see those kids again. And by default, the people who stay are those who weren't as successful in school, who don't have the brightest future, who don't have a place to go, who don't have money to go elsewhere out of town, and who have not seen the outside world. It also means that there are fewer immigrants because there are immigrants go to places that have jobs. So you end up with very little ethnic diversity. I am Asian American. My parents are from Taiwan. And I think that's another thing that startled me when I came was just how many people stared at me. I didn't take it personally. I really didn't. But I felt uncomfortable. And I realized that even just feeling anonymous was a privilege that people in urban areas have.
Everybody knows your business in a small town.
Yes. Whether you're Asian or not, I guess.
You went to Harvard University. How did your parents feel about you then going for a very low-paid teacher's position in a rural southern state?
They were extremely confused. So my parents are from Taiwan. If you know any Taiwanese immigrant parents, generally the stereotype is they want you to get a stable job. They want you to be a doctor. They have no idea what it would mean to purposely take a job in the middle of nowhere. And it was only when I was writing the book many years later that I really tried to think about where my parents are from. And I understood, okay, Taiwan is a small developing country that didn't have a democratic process. So my parents wouldn't have known helping professions, service professions, teaching for a mission, journalists, writers, artists, all of those were dangerous professions. They were professions that happen when you're in a democracy. So I understand now more where my parents were coming from. At the time, I just felt really alone, as, you know, Asian parents didn't get the memo about self-esteem. I was really jealous of my friends who had parents, and I would overhear their conversations. The parents would be like, "You're doing a great thing. Keep on going. Keep on trucking." Whereas if I called my parents and felt exhausted from the work, they would tell me to quit, or they'd say, "I told you so," or whatever. But my parents were very difficult, and they wanted me to leave.
You say at one point, one thing the stereotypes get wrong is that they don't go far enough sometimes when dealing with Asian immigrant parents.
Yeah, I joke about it now because humor is a way to deal, but there is a lot of profound miscommunication between immigrant parents and their kids about careers. And I felt that way with my parents, just intense heartbreak, intense feeling that I had somehow disappointed them, betrayed them. Because, you know, in our culture, to disobey your parents is to say, "I don't love you." And so you're always trying to convince your parents that you love them by obeying them. And that's extremely confusing, especially when you're 23 and you have these high ideals about who you want to be and attach so much importance to your career.
It was fascinating later on in the book when you talk about the stereotype of the tiger mother, and that you said it comes from a place of fear and not a place of strength.
Yeah, I love that you articulated that. There's this idea that the tiger parent, you know, is really powerful and strong and knows exactly what she wants from her kids. I think my mother, who definitely was a kind of a tiger mom and making me study all the time and being really disappointed with A minuses, I think it came from this place of being afraid. She didn't know how else to be. She herself didn't feel successful. She had to be that way because she didn't know how else to be.
We also learned in the book that she had academic disappointments of her own that probably fueled some of this.
Absolutely. So in Taiwan, also in other East Asian countries and Korea as well, there's just one test that you take at the end of 12th grade. And this one test determines so much of your future. It determines whether or not you can become a doctor, whether or not you get to achieve your dreams. And my mother panicked, as a lot of students do, the night before her test. And she didn't get to become what she wanted to be. And I think when she came to the U.S., she transferred a lot of that anxiety and self-disappointment to me and to my brother.
Now, when you were training for Teach for America, what had they given you tool-wise that was helpful? And then what do you wish desperately they would have taught you before you went to Helena?
Well, what they did, and I'm so grateful to Teach for America because they connected me to the Arkansas Delta. They connected me to this town that I otherwise wouldn't have known to come to. I'll always be grateful to them for doing that. And especially now, these days, when we talk about the rural-urban divide, you know, there are institutions like Teach for America that try to send college graduates to rural areas. That is amazing. I also really loved meeting older Teach for America core members who were Black and white and Asian, who had stayed in Arkansas, who had made that decision, even though they weren't from there. I thought that was really powerful. And they weren't saviors. They weren't martyrs. They were just people who found a home and they saw the need. They didn't take themselves too seriously to think they should be somewhere else, you know, which I think is the danger when you bring these outsiders to come who think they're too good to stay. It's funny, when Teach for America recruits you to come, they tell you it's going to be really hard and not to do it if you're not ready for it to be hard. And I thought they were just saying that to recruit you so you could be like, "Hey, I'm tough enough to do this." And then I realized, oh, they really meant that. It is really hard. And I didn't understand how hard it was to connect with people when your relationships are incredibly unequal because of race, because of class, because of what you've been exposed to in your life. And, you know, I still haven't figured out how to do that, but I felt like I had to try.
And Helena and Phillips County, like so many places in the South, has segregated school systems, and that's because white kids tend to attend private religious schools.
Absolutely. And that's another thing that startled me when I got to Helena was just, it's such a small town, and yet black and white kids grow up not interacting with each other. That is really devastating. Like, all the studies show that when white kids grow up around black kids, they're less likely to adopt racist attitudes. That's not to say that we can't have really amazing schools that are all black. Absolutely, we can. We do have them. But I don't think we should give up on this dream of having kids grow up in an integrated space.
What was STARS?
STARS was a short-lived experiment that died as soon as it was born, that was promising at the beginning and horrible at the end. It's an alternative school for kids who have been kicked out of other schools. And my students were 15 and 16, but some of them were, you know, in the seventh grade. So 2 years or 3 years too old to be in that grade.
Now, when your first day of class comes, did you have any thoughts about leaving on that first day?
Actually, no, because kids are all great on the first day. It's amazing. Actually, when I was working on my book and going back to my old emails that I sent on the first day of school, I was so happy, you know, and it's actually really profound and sweet to think about it, because it means that the worst kid who has a reputation for exploding or cussing out a teacher is a different person on the first day. Why? Because he has hope. Because he wants to have a chance at being a good kid. And that speaks to this universal desire among kids to feel good about themselves, to feel warmly about themselves, to feel like they deserve to be successful.
You tried to connect with them with some very important and profound works of writing and literature, and that's maybe a little bit too much too fast.
You're such a gentle way of portraying a painful part of the book. Yeah, you know, I mean, in college I studied civil rights history, I studied African-American literature, I studied all sorts of things that I thought I would be great at sharing with students who are African-American, who are from the South. It doesn't work. You can't fill people up with ideas of who you think their hero should be. I gave them Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and the students didn't connect. That's not to say students in other classes didn't, but my students at the alternative school in Helena did not. The language was a little difficult. The historical references, they didn't understand. But also, I think students, they're different. They all have different interests. They don't want to be told who their hero should be. One student really wanted to read kung fu stories, and I love that. Another student loved fantasy. Another student wanted to write his own lyrics to his songs. And I think I realized as a teacher that I have to really tap into what their individual gifts and inclinations and interests are and let them discover that on their own instead of viewing myself as a conduit for the great traditions.
The I Am Project was very important in getting to know these young people.
Yes, it's just a simple poem structure. You know, I am, I feel, I wonder, I dream, I pretend. Just a whole list of these simple prompts. And I told students to think of this as an, you know, as a way to talk about themselves. And it's interesting when students write, they're so different from how they speak. And that seems really deep to me. Just, it seems very true about how people are, right? When you're alone with your own thoughts, you kind of let your guard down. Maybe if you're praying, you kind of talk about your problems. You're more free to be broken. And when you are with people, you want to put up a front and be okay and seem strong. So it was really wonderful to me that I saw that happening in the classroom, that when they wrote, they kind of let down their guard. And when they shared their writing with each other, they could see each other as more nakedly as humans rather than as people who, you know, are tough.
So what front did you put up when you were their age?
A such a great question that's nobody asked before. Oh my God, you don't want to know who I was. Although I think my friend saw a picture of me at that age and just like burst out laughing, which wasn't very nice. You know, huge glasses that glinted alongside my braces that also glinted. Just a huge nerd. I mean, I probably tried to seem cool, but it was impossible because of how I looked. And I was extremely shy, you know, just an extremely shy person. I never raised my hand. I didn't do any sports. I gazed longingly at these twin girls who were athletic and like loved by everybody. Like, I didn't even understand negative emotions. I only understand now my intense jealousy of them. At the time, I was just like always looking at them and being like, oh, people love these girls. In Kalamazoo too, I was one of the few Asian Americans. It was a very welcoming community to immigrants, but I think I only understand now how self-conscious I was about that. I don't even know what my front was. I probably just tried to seem really normal while not actually appearing normal.
So with your parents having expectations of you taking a more traditional professional track, where do you account for trying to deal with America's most difficult problems?
Oh, wow. I don't know. That's a good question. You know, the book is about this question of can a book change a life? And at the end of the book, spoiler alert, it's not clear that Patrick, the subject of it, has been changed totally by books. But I know that books changed my life, at least when I was growing up. Because my parents were so adamant that I'd be reading all the time, they kind of let me just read on my own. And as we know, I wasn't the most popular kid. So I spent a lot of time just reading alone. And that's where I learned about the American South. And so I learned about the African American tradition. And that's where I learned about social justice. And it's also interesting because there wasn't any Asian American literature besides the Joy Luck Club growing up. There weren't any Asian Americans on television unless they were like a Chinese delivery man with a really horrible accent. So I really think I read a lot of African American literature, and that was my way of having some kind of racial consciousness. But I think it was also my way of fitting in because I saw African Americans as American, whereas I didn't think of Asian American as being American. I don't know if that makes sense or answers your question, or you can just edit it out since it's like rambling. Edit that one, Steve.
Well, let's meet the titular Patrick. What about Patrick attracted your attention amongst all the kids that you had in class?
So Patrick was quiet. He tried to break up a fight, which most students don't do. Most students are cheering. When you try to break up that fight, he got thrown to the ground, and he just seemed really capacious. If you gave him a poem that you really liked, he was really curious about it. There was a way in which he expressed so much just through his appreciation of silence. I had silent reading in class. Silent reading is an incredible time where it's like 20 minutes of kids just each with their own book. I wish I had videotaped them during silent reading and sent that to all of the teachers and the principals who thought that our school was for the bad kids and for kids who couldn't sit still or kids who were too angry to try to change, you know. Silent reading taught me how much the kids just really craved peace. They craved quiet. And reading was a way for them to go someplace else. And Patrick loved silent reading. He was always reading.
What type of things did he like to read?
He really loved different poems, like anthology of poems. He liked some fantasy. Yeah, he read anything that we had.
It was really striking. We'll get to the circumstances on how your studies continued later on, but that you said you thought his medium was poetry and it turned out to be letters.
Yes. So he has a gift for sounds, just hearing how sounds work and when they work. But we spent 7 months together in the county jail after he had gotten arrested for a crime. And at the end of the 7 months, he started writing these really remarkable letters to his daughter. And I realized that everybody has a different medium And during that time, it really was the letter. And as I was writing the book, I started to understand it had a lot to do with maybe his being religious, too. He's a very Christian. And he has always been somebody who prayed all the time. And his mother was praying all the time. And it made me really think about the letter as being like a prayer. Prayer is a letter to God. And a letter is this kind of openness, this direct address, this direct use of writing. A letter is also relaxing because you're talking to a friend, so you don't need to sound particularly smart. You can just be yourself, but you have to organize yourself because somebody else is watching. And he was writing letters to his daughter, so he wanted to be able to share with her what he was doing, what he was reading, and to be more of a father rather than just a guy.
He may not have had a lot of experience reading them necessarily, but it makes sense now. I just now thought of this because of the Pauline epistles in the New Testament, of the letters to the Romans, the letters to the Galatians, yes, and Ephesians and such, that would be a great point of connection there.
Yeah, that's so lovely that you said that. Absolutely. I think that's true. I think also, I mean, we were reading Marilynne Robinson's Gilead, a book I really love, and he really responded to that line she has in the book where she says something like, it's a father writing to a son, and the father says, you know, if you ever wonder what you have done in this life, and everybody does wonder at some point, you have been a miracle to me, more than a miracle. And I think he wanted to write something like that to his daughter, you know.
You decided to leave Helena and go to law school. Did you stay in touch with Patrick when you had left town for law school?
To be honest, not really. You know, when I left after the first 2 years, and this is a problem we know that rural areas have, people with means leave. And I really struggled with leaving. I felt like I was doing what everybody with means did to rural towns. And leaving behind my students. And I had promised Patrick that I would stay to see him graduate. And this was my way of keeping him in school because he had a lot of trouble staying in school. But then I left. I got into law school. My parents really wanted me to go to law school. I was also really lonely. Being a single professional in a rural area means being lonely unless you're one of those lucky people who couple up really fast. So I left, and first year of law school is really terrible. It just swallows you up. I didn't really think too much about my decision, maybe because I didn't want to think about how I'd had this tremendous experience and yet cut it short. And then my third year of law school, I got a phone call from my friend who had stayed in the Delta, and he told me that Patrick had gotten into a fight and killed someone. And I felt really devastated. I started thinking about the Delta. I hadn't kept in touch with him, and I wished I had.
Did the fact that this violent incident happened in his attempt to protect his sister from a predatory older man, did that make it easier to want to help him further as opposed to if he had done something that a more of a mercenary event?
That's an interesting question that I've never thought about. I honestly can't imagine any crime that he would have done that would have made me not want to help him, but maybe I'm just not thinking of, you know, a totally sociopathic crime, because I knew he wasn't a sociopath, you know. I didn't even know the story of what had happened when I went back to visit him. I actually thought it was a mistake. I thought it was like they'd gotten the wrong guy, because Patrick hadn't been violent in my class. He had been totally somebody who broke up fights. And I naively didn't understand that you can be a pretty peaceful person who stays away from trouble and gets sucked in if you live in a poor neighborhood and if you are surrounded by danger.
Just a horrible occurrence of moral luck.
Yes. Yes. I talk a little bit about this in the book, about the way luck works in poor neighborhoods. You just have many more tests that you have to pass. You're presented with many more tests. Like, I didn't have any tests when I was growing up because it was a pretty safe neighborhood. But if you live in a dangerous neighborhood, there's going to be more tests. There's going to be more. And in this case, the test was that an older drunk guy came back with his younger sister, who's special ed, on a school night. And Patrick kept telling him to get off the porch. The guy wouldn't get off the porch. Patrick possibly, arguably, overreacted, or arguably was defending himself and stabbed the guy. This is the test Patrick was faced with, and I hope readers think about what would I have done in that situation. Also, when I grew up in a place where the police doesn't respond or investigate, and where you do feel like you have to protect yourself, and you do feel like you have to protect your younger siblings. I mean, we often think of violence as something we're not capable of. Like, I wouldn't have done that in that situation. And I just don't believe that. I think everybody is capable of breaking and quote unquote overreacting. And it totally changes Patrick's life. I mean, it utterly changes all of his life outcomes. There is a way in which he can't uncross the line, you know. I mean, the book tries to do that. I try to go back and help him. But even now, after the book is done, after all of his extraordinary changes, I still feel that it was too late, that if this crime hadn't happened, he would have a totally different life.
Violence permeates much of the South, and there's a horrible specific occurrence that happens in the history of Phillips County, and it's the Elaine Massacre of 1919. And growing up, I had heard of the Tulsa Massacre of 1921, but even living in the state of Arkansas, I hadn't heard of what happened in Elaine.
I'm glad you brought up Elaine. I didn't hear about Elaine when I came to Phillips County. I heard briefly about it here and there when I was in Phillips County, but in no systematic way. And that, to me, is mind-boggling, you know, that there wasn't any commemoration or marker, or people weren't feeding me left and right ways to teach about it, or ways to get elderly who have stories about it, both black and white, into the classroom to share these stories with students and make sense of them. That's a profound kind of silence. And I only started really researching it until much later, when I was working on the book, and then wishing I had done more to think about it when I had been in Helena.
Now, at one point, Patrick talks about how you cared, and that meant so much to him that someone cared about him. But he seemed to love his mother very much. He loved his sisters, and they seemed to care about him. So was it just needing outside validation beyond familial love?
So his family loved him profoundly, especially his mother, who sadly passed away shortly after he got out of jail. But that kind of love is painful. I mean, his mother and sisters stopped visiting him in jail because they kept crying, and Patrick didn't like to be the reason why they were crying. You know, he felt really guilty, like he had let everybody down, like he was causing them pain. So when he said that it meant something that I cared, I think he was also saying, like, this means less to you than it does to my family, and I need somebody who can stay calm and has access to resources and can help me in these concrete ways. And I think he is talking about adults. I mean, it's really crazy to me how few adults he had helping him. Like, his lawyer hadn't visited him because he's underpaid and overworked, has over 100 clients, and he had no former teachers. There weren't counselors at our school. There weren't teams with coaches. He didn't go to church, so there was no pastor. I mean, there was just nobody. And certainly nobody in his family, you know, had graduated from high school, I want to say. They love him profoundly, but it just means that they don't have access to different resources and opportunities, you know.
So in coming back down to Helena, you take a job teaching Spanish, which you probably weren't quite qualified for.
That is true. So after I graduated from law school, decided to come back for just a little bit to make peace with the Delta, to visit Patrick in jail, just to do something useful. And then pretty quickly, school contacted me and wanted me to teach Spanish, had heard that I took college Spanish. I didn't feel qualified to do it, but then they reminded me that I was in the Delta. There weren't any Spanish-speaking immigrants to teach Spanish. So I took that job and then pretty soon was horrified at how little I knew.
Later on, in another location, you had to teach math, which you didn't feel comfortable with either.
Yes, it's correct.
So in dealing with a relationship that can be so intense, I mean, you're going almost every day to see him, to help him with his reading poetry, which touches the soul, but still you have to build boundaries of a relationship with a person, especially if you're kind of like their soul connection to the outside. What was the process of learning those boundaries and what was important for each of you to protect yourself in some way?
Yeah, I think that's really hard in any relationship where one person's supposed to be a mentor or a helper or a counselor. I mean, counselors, teachers, and lawyers are all given these rules from the beginning. You know, one, don't give them money. You know, two, if there's any kind of flirtation, shut that down. So I gave those trainings when I worked at a homeless shelter before. So I was comfortable creating boundaries, but the difficult thing here with Patrick was just that I was forcing myself to be a teacher. I wasn't a teacher anymore. In that sense, I really worried that I only knew how to form a relationship with a person through exerting authority over them. And I think that's very uncomfortable. It seems so patronizing. It's like, but then I think it's also necessary.
We really shouldn't go much more deeply into the story because people need to read the book. But also what follows is a tale complex, not a Hollywood narrative, and so much so complicated that only real life can be that way.
Thanks for saying that. It is not a Hollywood narrative. It isn't a profoundly depressing ending, I think, but it's not a happy ending where I've rescued him and the reader can feel like the work is done. You know, I think somebody told me that the book was about humans being human, and I felt really gratified by that. It's two people trying to create a connection in spite of incredible inequality between them, and I think that trying is really important. But I think it's also about communities and how they also need to come together to integrate ex-felons into society, to read together as people, because reading together is so much more intimate than reading alone. It's about all of these things.
So reading together, you say, is important, but writing can be a very solitary task. How do you fight the loneliness when you're writing?
Yes, every writer is so lonely. Oh, gosh. I don't think I have an answer to that. How do you make writing less lonely? What a great question.
I guess I could make some money if I figured out the answer to that one.
You know, okay, there's a few practical things to say. Writing groups are great. Sharing writing with people is great. And having a specific time where you decide you're going to stop writing, you know, and then you're going to go see people and call old friends and be social. I think that's the stuff of life that really matters. The writing is just a way to capture that life and capture the silence of that life, you know.
Do you have another project you're working on that's aimed at a mainstream audience, or are you working on anything academic right now?
Oh, gosh. I'm just working on not that much. Just trying to share the story and not be a terrible teacher. Teach college courses now on race, law, and society. Trying to get back comments to students about their papers. I would love to work on something, another book. I haven't started anything really substantial quite yet.
Well, Michelle, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to come up and talk to us. It's very much an honor to have you here.
It's an honor to speak to you, Steve. You're such a brilliant interviewer. I'm so glad that we got to connect in Memphis and also in a library that I used to come to all the time, like all the time when I was a teacher in Helena. It was one of my refuges.
Thank you. Michelle Kuo is the author of the memoir, Reading with Patrick, A Teacher, a Student, and a Life-Changing Friendship, which is published by Random House. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.